Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled A Policy for Change, presented by John DeGraff.
And what was Moses called on to do when God spoke to him from the burning bush? What was
to confront the powers that be.
Go and confront the powers that be. Go to Pharaoh and lead people out. God didn't suggest to Moses that he just sort of personally escape to Canaan, that he just kind of take off on his own, or that he get a few friends and they kind of together just take off on his own. He called on him to go to Pharaoh and challenge Pharaoh to let the Israelites go, and he promised to stand beside Moses. And I should use inclusive language. God promised to stand behind Moses in that work. The Apostle Paul speaks of the principalities and powers which stand above human beings and oppress them. But not all of our failings and our sins are purely personal, and suggests too that we are called upon to challenge the evil that these principalities and powers often perpetuate. And I want to suggest today that we can create some new public policies and new institutions that can help free us from bondage to overwork and to time poverty as a society. Before I do that, I want to show you about 5 minutes of a television program that I made many years ago, actually in the early 1980s. It was a film called Dairy Queens. The title was kind of one that was actually forced on us by PBS. We sort of came up with it as a joke and made a lot of it. But it's actually the story of three Minnesota farm women who were fighting to save their farms during the farm crisis of the late 1970s and the early 1980s. And one of those women is Ann Canton, who was her husband. Chuck raised wheat, soybeans, and sugar beets out in western Minnesota, a place called Milan. Anybody here know Ann? Usually there's Ann and Chuck are very active members of the Lutheran Church, and there's usually somebody when I talk about this who actually knows Ann and knows kind of what's up with her, but I haven't talked to her in a while. But anyway, Ann and Chuck were very devout Lutherans. They had not been, prior to this particular time, politically active. They and their neighbors were good farmers. They had done everything right as the banks and the extension agents and all the farm experts told them to. They had been also very frugal. They worked 14 to 16 hour days to keep their farm running. But they were going deep into debt because it cost them, and it cost many farmers at the time, more money to produce their crops than they could sell them for. So this was a common problem. I think it still is a common problem for many, many small farmers in America today, and one of the reasons that we're losing our farms. But at that particular point, Ann realized that they had to get political. They had to change the system, not just their own farming practices, because they had been trying to make changes in how they farmed for a long time, and it just wasn't doing the job. So I'm going to show you this clip about Anne's, it's a short clip about Anne's transition and her ending up getting involved in political activities, kind of based on the theme that we've been talking about this week.
God came to Moses through the burning bush. He said, I realize the suffering that your people are going through in Egypt. And he said, Moses, go to Pharaoh. That's where the military and the political decisions are made. And what that little story says to me is that we indeed have a responsibility to challenge the pharaohs. we can get all this business settled real quick now. If we get 5,000 women arm it with a rolling pin and send them to Washington, D.C.
In 1977,
Anne and a small group of farm women heard about a new farm organization, the American Agriculture Movement.
The whole thrust and idea was that we can do something about it ourselves. And it's at the point where we have to do something, that we can no longer rely on the experts. If we want to survive on this land, it's up to the people of the land to do it.
They began to organize meetings, small at first, but larger as farmers heard that others were demanding a fair price and a living wage.
It just got more exciting, and we got to the point where we were organized enough to put together a march on the Capitol in St. Paul. Because I'd never protested bodily ever to say that I, as a farmer, was protesting. It was scary for me, but it was also terribly exciting. And the next step then was to say something nationally. We arrived at Washington early in the morning, found our way to Capitol Hill, finally found a place to park, walked for blocks, came around the corner of the capital of the United States and saw 40,000 farmers. I cried. Couldn't believe it. I remember how good that was for Chuck. Because he grabbed me and he said, "We aren't the only ones."
I've been talking to them congressmen, I thought you know. I've been talking to them senators, way down that road. I'm tired of all your lies, bribes, and corporate crime. I've been doing some hard traveling alone.
A year later, in January 1979, they were back, this time with their tractors. They demanded federal policies that would guarantee a fair price for farm products and the survival of the family farm.
We found out that we could walk into senators' offices and congressmen's offices, and we could talk to them. We knew what the issues were, and we could say it straight and strong and hopefully get them to understand. Of course, they didn't understand. But Moses had to go many times. It was the 10th time that Pharaoh finally agreed, and he said, "Go, take your people."
Anne, sometime after that, actually became the Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Minnesota. Her husband, Chuck, was very active in international agricultural affairs for the Lutheran Church for many years. And I've just lost touch with him recently. That's why I was wondering if anybody knew. But I think that clip makes the point that Anne interpreted that passage in Exodus as our duty to challenge the pharaohs to go out and take on the structures, not only to change personally, but to take on the structures that make it hard for all of us. And I would contend that when we look at the United States and this whole issue of time poverty, of overwork, of pressure, and we compare it to other industrial countries, we actually find how really unique we are. I mentioned in the first session, some of you were there, but I'm going to mention this again, a study done by the Harvard University School of Public Health. It's called the Global Working Family Study, and if you want to find out about it, just go to www.globalworkingfamilies.org. And you can find the whole study, and it is very revealing. Shocking, actually, from my perspective. What the study does is it takes a look at 168 countries around the world, essentially every country in the world with a population of more than a million people. And it looks at a number of kinds of things that these countries have in terms of protections on people's time and their right to have time for themselves and for their families and away from the workplace. And it starts out with paid family leave, for parents when they have a child, for example, or leave to take care of elderly relatives or sick relatives, but primarily this issue of parental leave, in most cases maternal leave, when a child is born. And the study found that of the 168 countries in the world studied, 163 of those countries have some form of guaranteed paid maternal leave at childbirth. 163 low-income countries, middle-income countries, all industrial countries. All countries except, and I mentioned this before, I'm not making this up, the United States, Swaziland, Lesotho, Burkina Faso, and Papua New Guinea. This is it. There are only five countries in the world that do not recognize that it is really important for parents to have time early in life to bond with their children, and that it often takes some kind of paid leave to make that possible. We in the United States have what's called the Family and Medical Leave Act. You may have heard of that. It gives people who work in firms with over 50 employees the right to take 3 months of unpaid leave off work when a child is born. Now, even that law, which actually pollsters found was the most popular law passed during the entire Clinton administration, one of the first laws, was passed in 1993. The most popular law passed during the Clinton administration is now under attack. And there is an effort in Congress to get rid of it. Even that, and that's unpaid. Secondly, paid sick leave. The study found that 139 of 168 countries, including all of the other industrial countries, provide at least a week of paid sick leave to all workers. We don't. And I think we pay a high price for that, because we have in the United States a situation where a lot of people come to work sick, and they get other people sick, and their productivity is lower. They stay sick longer. Sometimes they don't take care of themselves for too long, and they tax our medical system. Paid vacations, paid annual leave. 96 of 168 countries have guaranteed paid vacations for all workers, including every other industrial country. And in Europe, it's a minimum of 4 weeks. Why is that important? Well, one thing we find is that people who take vacations of 2 weeks or more actually suffer about half as many heart attacks as those who do not take vacations, and there are many other health impacts of that as well. Limits on work time. 75 of 168 countries limit the amount of time that people can be forced to work during the course of a week. In Europe, the number is 48 hours. That's the max. Canada has laws based on provinces, in many cases 44 to 48 hours. The United States has no limit on the amount of hours that you can be required by your employer to work in the course of a week, so long as the employer is willing to pay the overtime premium. The exception is the state of Maine, and I'll tell you a little story about that. Back in 1999, there was a huge ice storm in the northeastern part of the United States and the southeastern part of Canada. And after that ice storm, there were power lines down everywhere. And there was a man named Brent Churchill, who was a power line worker, who had been trying to put those lines back up and had spent 96 hours on the job in the effort to do this. And he was so exhausted that at one point he forgot to put on his protective gloves. He grabbed a power line and he was electrocuted. And as a result, the state of Maine, people got up in arms about this, how long we're having people working, and they passed what was called Brent's Law, and it sets a limit. Anyone want to guess what the limit is?
95.
Be close. 80 hours a week. So, but that's the best. That's as good as it gets. 45 countries have a guaranteed paid leave for fathers. And Sweden, this is an interesting one. Sweden is a country that's been not only very concerned about these things. I think the Swedes really understand the importance of childbirth leave and what it means to young children in terms of, in the long run, their health, what kind of people they grow up to be, delinquency, all these kinds of things are affected by that. And so the Swedes have quite generous childbirth leave policies, but they are also very concerned with gender equity. And so Sweden just this past month passed a new law which gives 15 months of childbirth leave at somewhere between 80 and 90% of pay. But it requires that fathers take 5 of those 15 months. Mothers have to take 5 of the 15 months, and the family can decide who takes the remaining 5, how they break that up. But Sweden has decided now that fathers really need to play a role in the early life of their children, and so they're now requiring 5 months of paternal leave when people have a child. One of the reasons this happens, I think, is that Sweden has by far the highest percentage of women in legislative office of any country in the world. About 45% of the Swedish parliament is female. That compares to about 14% in the United States. But in any case, the United States has none of these laws that we just have been talking about. Now, how many, I kind of want a show of hands, how many of you personally have had some of these benefits, these paid leave benefits?
Well, I used my sick leave and annual leave. I had 9 months off with my daughter and son. And with my son, I had less pay because I had less accumulated.
Uh-huh. But you got,
I used my own.
You had paid sick leave and were able to
paid
use that. And did you get some kind of paid parental leave too, or you just used your annual leave? Okay.
For my daughter, I was pretty much covered half time for the whole 9 months. But for my son, it only lasted 2 months.
Okay. And the others of you who had your hands up?
I got 6 weeks with my first child. The first, I had to use up my sick leave first, and then there was another threshold before it kicked in, so there was a gap in between, and then it paid for part of myself.
And who was your employer?
I was a City of Bothell. And I was the first one coming through with a baby in about 30 years, so they had to go searching back to check what statutes they were going to use on it.
Wow. How many others said that? Yes?
I had to use, I work for University of Arizona. I had to use paid sick leave before I could take unpaid family leave. Now get this. My daughter was adopted, so I was taking paid sick leave when there was absolutely no health involvement on my part. And I was depleting that in order to take leave to be with her.
Yes.
Our second son was born in the United States, and we had some leave time from our congregation. Then we took a sabbatical in Berlin, and immediately when we moved to Berlin, the benefits of living in Germany kicked in.
Even though you were American.
Oh, yeah, immediately. And so we were able to have lots of benefits in terms of child care while we were students and other and medical insurance.
I wasn't aware that they kick in even if you're not a citizen, although I did have the
it might have changed. That was in 1987.
Yeah, I don't know. I did have the, I guess you could call it pleasant experience. Actually, it wasn't a pleasant experience, but I was run over by a motorcycle in Rome, which was not a pleasant experience, and immediately taken by ambulance to a Roman hospital. This was back in 2002, actually, when we were filming the World Food Summit, and was taken care of very quickly, and they told me, they x-rayed me, and they said, well, you know, the good news is you don't have a broken leg, you don't have a broken arm, because my arm is about like this, and my leg was like this, black and blue. The bad news is that you have broken ribs, and we can't really do a whole lot about those, except just kind of tape you up and give you some morphine and send you out and, you know, take it easy for a few months until the ribs heal. But they took very good care of me, and they just asked me to look at my passport when I came in, and I showed it to them, and they handed it right back to me. And when I was done, I expected maybe there would be a bill, and they said, no, no charge, Italian hospitality, no cost. We don't charge in our hospital, even for me, who was not Italian. And when I came back to the States, the doctors at Group Health in Seattle, where I go regularly, looked at me and said, they did all the right things. They did a great job. You're looking good. So that was quite an eye-opener for me as well. Yes?
I had that experience on a tour of Italy where I fell and injured my arm. And everything was free because I was an outpatient through the whole thing. They said if I'd been hospitalized, there would have been a charge.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but not too many of us have had these kind of benefits. Who's most likely to get paid benefits in our society?
Salaried employees. Administration or management.
Who's least likely to get paid benefits in our society?
The poor,
hourly workers, part-time workers, usually no benefits whatsoever. Pardon?
Self-employed.
Right. And and even self-employed in many of these other countries do get the benefits because, again, the benefits are part of the national social security programs of these particular countries. How many of you have heard of the name George Lakoff? There's one up there, one in the back. George Lakoff, there's a book by George Lakoff in the bookstore. I saw it there. It's called Don't Think of an Elephant, is our name for a book. But George Lakoff is kind of a guru of what's called framing. It's kind of politically making things palatable. He's learned a lot, and actually has studied some of the work of people like Frank Luntz, who's George Bush's pollster and focus group leader. Frank Luntz is the fellow who has given us such wonderful names as the Healthy Forests Initiative, which George Lakoff says maybe would be more properly called No Tree Left Behind. But anyway, the Healthy Forest Initiative, the Clear Skies Initiative, which is about more pollution in the atmosphere, and no Child Left Behind, all these kinds of things. Anyway, Frank Luntz is very good at what he does. And George Lakoff has talked about the necessity for people who want to make some changes in a different direction to be a little better about how they frame their messages, what kind of language they use, how they talk to people about these particular things. And George Lakoff has also suggested that
to succeed in getting some of these kinds of things through Congress, through legislative bodies, what's needed are what he calls strategic initiatives. And these initiatives are not just a single bill here about one aspect of something or a single bill over there, but in fact, a group of bills together about a single issue, which if they were passed as a package, might have a lot of positive impacts on many other things. And one of the suggestions that he makes and that others have made is an initiative that's been proposed called the New Apollo Project. Anybody heard of that? A new Apollo Project is a project to address issues like peak oil and the energy costs, energy crisis, pollution, a number of things. It's about money being put into alternative sources of energy. That would be a policy that could create thousands of jobs, that could give us less polluting energy, that could do something about global warming. It could do a number of things, but it's for us, reduce our dependence on foreign oil and consequently maybe reduce also our military activity as well. And so we've been talking in the movement of people who are trying to do something about the issue of time about creating a strategic initiative that would address publicly, in a policy sense, some of these time issues. So what I want to do is have a little brainstorm here. And I want to, if you were developing an initiative, an idea about some of the things that we could do through law at a state or a national level to address some of these issues, I'd just like to know what you think might be the most important things. And just tell me if there's something you think could be done, how long, if it's a guarantee of some kind of leave, how long it should be, for example. And let's just come up with a few points that might make a strategic initiative. Tell me why you think this particular thing is important and who you think might benefit the most as well. Anyone want to kick that off?
I'm a little confused. What is this initiative exactly for? Is it for time? Is it for the environment?
For time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is for these issues we've been talking about time and leave and some of the things that other countries have that we don't have. What would you think, and we can't do all these things, but what would you think would be the most significant things that we could do for a starter? Yes, in the back.
I think the number one thing above everything else would be national health insurance, because if we all felt that we had health insurance, I believe we would feel a lot freer to go from one job to another or to take part-time work or to ask for what we really need or to leave a bad employer. And the thing that holds most people back is concern about losing their health insurance.
Okay. National health insurance, number one. And the points made here are very true, that both, this is not only true, how could you make this argument in a way that wouldn't just be about the workers, but also might be palatable to employers, to management?
It would be much less expensive for employers if they didn't have to be in charge of subsidizing health insurance. It would be a lot easier for the business community, and it would be a lot better for everyone else because we'd all be in one big pool sharing the risks equally, and you wouldn't have huge winners versus huge losers. People would be less fearful and feel more empowered to take any kind of job they wanted.
Okay. It's a big burden right now on some companies. I mean, there are other companies that don't provide it or increasingly find ways to not do it. And then we pay. Yeah. And that may be a way to persuade the politicians. Let's have some more. Yeah, Michael?
Well, just an example with the national health insurance, what's happening right now, since I'm from Canada, General Motors is talking about cutting back a lot of their plants and employees and everything, but all the plants are in Canada are untouched because they're profitable because of national health insurance, universal care in Canada. Because they don't have to, the company does not have to pay those health benefits, it's definitely factories they want to keep operational. So it does offer job security.
Absolutely so true.
It is positive for the for the employers as well as for employees.
Yeah, especially General Motors is a company very, very aware of this, and Ford and the others, because it costs them about $1,000 more per average car to make it here, and it's not about the wages, it's about the health benefits. GM currently is paying out five times as much money each year to take care of the health care costs of its retirees, people who no longer even work for General Motors, than it makes in profit. So you can see that that becomes a somewhat untenable situation. What besides anything related to the time thing that seems like it would be most, what do you think might be the most sellable that people would, of things like vacation, sick leave, family leave, these kind of things, what do you think might be palatable? Yes?
It seems like a lot of people have to work a lot to pay for child care. Mm-hmm. So it gives some protection with child care amounts of money that people have to pay for their child care.
So you would say having some kind of subsidized child care? Okay. And this is another thing that is most other industrial countries do in a big way. I mean, they do make child care after a certain point in the child's life basically the same as going to public school. So people can afford to do so. Some of those countries don't start child care, though. One of the interesting things is that children in the United States more commonly go to daycare younger than kids do in other industrial countries, because parents go back to work much quicker. In many of those other countries, children do go to daycare, but not until they're somewhat older. And some countries take a different approach. The Netherlands has taken, I think, what's a very interesting approach in that they passed a law, which is now becoming the norm in the rest of Europe, in which they allow anyone, but the law is primarily taken up by parents with small children, anyone to say, I want to reduce my work hours. And you go to your employer and you're working 40 hours and you say, I want to work 32 hours. Now you have to be willing to take 32 hours pay, but your salary is prorated. You keep the same hourly salary, and your benefits are prorated. Your benefits other than health care, and then health care is a benefit that you get anyway, so you keep that. And your employer is required to allow you to do that unless they can show that there's a particular hardship to the firm that would be caused by letting you go to part-time. This has been done to encourage particularly parents who have young children to work less. And it's paying off to the extent that now the Netherlands has the highest percentage of part-time workers in the world. About 42% of all Dutch workers are working part-time. That is less than 32 hours a week. And the common situation in Holland, it's definitely not as gender equal as Sweden, for example. The common situation is that it's the woman may be working 2-3 days a week, and the husband may be working 4 or sometimes 5. But the parents have the majority of parents of small children in the Netherlands now work only part time, and if they do this, they may send their child to childcare, but only maybe 2 days a week. So they're home the other part, and it saves some money in certain other areas. That law is now has now become policy to take effect, I think, next year in the other countries of the European Union, because it has been very, very successful. But anyway, let's just take a couple more minutes here and just see what other. I haven't heard anything yet specifically about. Yes, Michael.
A statutory holiday every month. So at least once a month, you have a three-day weekend.
Okay, more holidays. Yeah, this is a very interesting point. One suggestion that's been made is that if the economy grows at about 2% a year, which is normal, that would allow us to take, without any loss of growth at all, that is, to take off about 4 days, to add about 4 days holidays per year to every worker's amount of holidays. Now, if we only took half that, as we put half of it into more growth, and we took 2 days off, more days off per year, we could do that with only 1% growth. And what that would mean is that after 8 years of adding only 2 days per year, after 8 years, every American worker would have every other weekend as a three-day weekend with no real negative impact. So that's one suggestion that's out there. More holidays. And it tends to be a tough one. A lot of businesses really don't like holidays. There's a lot of... Yes?
I know this would be extremely unpopular, but what would be the benefits if we could go back to where things are closed on Sunday?
Sunday closures, okay. Well, I think that's... What do people think about that? What do you think about the pros and cons of trying to regain Sunday closures? Any reactions?
That other religious traditions have other days as their Sabbath.
Is there a way we could get around that? I mean, to their benefit?
Choose the day, and then that would help some people working on Sundays.
Add an eighth day to the week, and then you just pull
out. Add another day, yeah. Well, of course, one of the interesting things is that most of the European countries still have Sunday closures. Most stores and things are not open. I was just recently in Nova Scotia, and I don't know what it's like in other parts of Canada, but I was recently in Nova Scotia, and the big stores are not open on Sunday. I was in a little town called... Antigonish, Nova Scotia, that had just, they were telling me how sad they were because the town had just gotten a Walmart. But the Walmart could not open on Sunday, and none of the big box stores.
That was up for plebiscite 2 years ago, whether or not to keep Sunday closure or have stores open on Sunday. And it was, I think, about 60%. Of those voted for Sunday closure.
This was all across Canada?
No, just Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia. What about in Saskatchewan where you live?
We're open on Sunday.
Okay. Any other?
There's been a fair amount of talk about leave in connection with caring for young children, but as we get an aging population, there's a big crunch on elder care. When you start looking at the statistics on Alzheimer's and everything else increasing, that too takes its toll, usually on women that are trying to do caretaking and still have their job be in jeopardy or doing both. A few places you may have the recognition for caring for young children. I know of very few where there's anything where you're allowed leave to care for your in-laws or your parents.
What would you do about that? What kind of policy would you suggest?
Paid family, like a family leave act, a paid family leave.
A paid family leave. How much do you think would be fair? How much do you think that we could talk about in terms of paid leave for childbirth or for taking care of older people and have most Americans think it was a good idea? Any? Yes?
3 months.
3 months.
How often? 3 months, how often?
How often? 3 months, how often?
Well, if it's for childbirth, then it would be for
child, but or if it was to take care of other family members, I'm not sure. I didn't put any thought into that.
You might have to split those two things. You might have to split the two things. 3 months is a well. Three months is actually a fairly common number around the world. It's pretty low for most industrial countries, but it's pretty common around the world. I will tell you that in Canada, it's a year, and it's at 55% of salary. It was, 6 months until not too long ago, right, Michael?
2 years ago. Yeah.
2 years ago it was 6 months. It's now been increased to a year. England just went from 3 months to 6 months. So, but let's say, okay, something like 3 months. 3 months is what the Family Leave Act is right now. Yes?
If it would be that they could stay in the family or something so that some of these elderly people could live in the family home, that would save a lot of public costs in taking care of them. And probably they wouldn't even become so senile so quickly if they weren't all shoved off into almost an asylum feeling.
I think that that's true, and we do see that in other countries as well.
Or Alzheimer's, 3 months would be just that wouldn't even help.
Yeah, that's a very tough one. Let's just say, you know, but how much we can do with this is very difficult to say what society would allow, because we will have to, you know, balance what might be doable. Yes, Mike?
I just think that having a living wage, a living minimum wage, would be so helpful for single parents that have two part-time, you know, string together a series of part-time jobs and often then exceed by 20 hours, a 40-hour week, and who are tired and exhausted. And do work so hard because they need that money in order to just make fair ends meet.
Living wage for poorer workers. Again, if you look at that, if you look at one of the situations where that's concerned, if you take basically the minimum wage and the material standard of living that the wage combined with the social benefits provides in other industrial countries, it tends to be about double at the bottom what is the case here. So that might mean a minimum wage that was about twice what our... Actually, today, if the minimum wage today were even in real terms what it was in the 1960s, when I remember working on the minimum wage at a hamburger place, it would be over $8 an hour. You know, but it's what? Well, in this state, it's something over 7. Washington has the highest minimum wage in the country, but I think nationally it's only 5.65 or something like that. Any other?
I just have a question. How do other countries finance it? Because if it's up to the employer, then the cost of living is going to go up, and you know, higher minimum wage isn't going to do people any good. So, is it?
They do have higher taxes, yes, and you pay for these kinds of things in certain ways, and it's kind of a complex issue. But in terms of, for instance, medical care, we Americans pay a lot more than the other countries pay. We actually pay almost as much in taxes as they pay in taxes. On top of that, we pay all the private costs that we have. It's really, really quite stunning. The United States spends almost as much per person on health care, on government money for health care, as every other country does. But on top, but we spend even more money for private. So that's why it's so big. And some of the costs come later. I mean, the cost of one of the things we're learning is if you don't pay, for instance, for the cost of early childhood education and family leave and these kind of things, we really pay the cost later. We have much less healthy kids overall. We have more problems with kids than we have. We have obviously an enormous prison population in this country that's staggeringly greater than virtually any other country. Now the Russians have almost as many prisoners as we do, but when you look at the Western European countries, it's maybe anywhere between a fourth as many prisoners per capita to about a tenth as many prisoners per capita. And it costs us a lot to deal with that. It also makes our unemployment figures look low compared to other countries. Because, for instance, the Germans say, we have a lot of folks who, if we didn't take care of them with a social safety net, might end up turning to crime in order to make ends meet, like many people do in your country. So we pay for them, we keep them going through some kind of safety net, and we count them as unemployed. If they were in your country, you wouldn't be doing that. They might end up in prison, and then you don't have to count them as unemployed. And that would add considerably to our role. So there are all these other kinds of costs, but it gets quite complicated. I'm gonna just mention the agenda that we are working on currently with the Take Back Your Time movement. We have what's called a Time to Care initiative. And we should be, I think in time we will try to include some of the other points that have been made here, because they're all very, very good points. But I don't have time to explain our reasoning for the particular things that we came up with on our six that we're actually trying to get legislators to start to look at. But our number one is family leave. We really, especially I think we believe that this is an issue that can cross political lines. Time is a family value, and it's an issue that really can allow us dialogue with people completely on the other side of the fence from many of us politically. We can have those conversations, and we are starting to have those kinds of conversations over things like family leave, sick leave, and we haven't set an amount. We've actually only been pushing for 6 weeks, just as a basic minimum to get the idea started. We tried a campaign in Washington State this year for 5 weeks, and we failed. It's that difficult, but we'll get it back up there.
Is that per year or what?
Pardon?
Per year?
Per child, you know, when you have a child.
Wait, okay. You're not talking about sick leave, now you're talking about...
That's family leave. No, sick leave we're talking about 1 week.
Okay.
1 week paid sick leave. And that there is a bill in Congress now that's advocating that. It's... At this point, they're not able to get that one out of committee. Our third one is 3 weeks paid vacations. And we think this is especially important for poor Americans who really are the least likely to get any kind of paid vacation time. We have a situation in this country where nearly 30% of working Americans don't get any paid vacation at all. People don't take it. Many people, more people all the time, are actually giving up even vacation that they have coming.
Is that for full-time employees?
3 weeks would be for full-time, and then we would see these things as being prorated based on... It would be 3 weeks anyway, but if you're only working 3 days a week, then you would only get 3 days a week vacation.
So you get 9 days.
Yes. Then limits on overtime. We have a huge situation of mandatory overtime in this country, people really being required to work very, very long hours. And we would advocate that after 48 hours on the job per week, the employee should at least have the right to refuse further overtime work. Overtime should be voluntary after that point. Yes?
But isn't the reason we have so much mandatory overtime because employers won't hire extra people because of the health insurance costs.
It is absolutely true. That's one of the reasons why we have so much mandatory overtime. It's absolutely true. Don't get me wrong, I'm in favor of health care. But it's been an issue that in many ways has been completely stymied. It's tough. And so we're trying to go at some of these other things because we feel in some ways we have a little more chance to get some people on board. And then we will work together also with people on the healthcare issue because we think that's very important. Our fifth one is part-time parity, and that's to allow people actually to choose to work less and still keep benefits prorated and still be able to keep their basic salary. Because we hear from many, many people that if they really had that choice, they would take that choice. And our sixth point is one that seems sort of superficial, but it's a kind of a symbolic point, and that's making Election Day a holiday. And the point behind that is that Americans really need time to participate in civic life, and that this is sort of a symbol of that need. Many other countries have their elections on either on Sundays or on Saturdays or on some day when people are not working. We are now also going toward issues like health care and like living wage. Those are the other two things that we've been talking a lot about. But all of these things are tough. But we do think that this is a kind of an issue whether it's really possible to make some alliances out there. What else do I want to? Well, I'm gonna bring this to a close here pretty soon, but in the next 5 minutes. But I want to mention there's still some flyers left that you can, of course, find out more about the National Take Back Your Time campaign at timeday.org. We are having a North American conference in Seattle the first weekend in August for people who would be in Seattle or who live in Seattle that might want to attend, or if you're from somewhere else and you're particularly interested in this issue, and you can find out about that on this green flyer or on our website. We are encouraging other congregations to begin to follow the model of the Massachusetts Council of Churches, which is partnering with us in promoting both our time to care agenda and also promoting what they call the four windows of time. That's encouraging people between Labor Day and Take Back Your Time Day to just set aside four days which they do not schedule all kinds of things, but really spend time with their family. They have a lot of other suggestions about what to do during these four windows of time, what we can do to begin to slow down. Massachusetts Council of Churches is encouraging. Last year they encouraged pastors to do sermons about this issue, talk with their congregations, even to also have discussions after the services. Last year Time Day fell on Sunday. This year it will fall on Monday, but this year on the Sunday before. And there are and will be many sample sermons that we start already having, because last year a lot of pastors did sermons in Massachusetts on Take Back Your Time Day, and we're collecting a lot of those so that other people can use some of the information there. And we know that pastors are overworked, and this can make it easier to read through some of these things and not have to reinvent the wheel on all of this. We're also encouraging things like potlucks and things where people just can kind of come together with the congregation and talk about this. I think your church did something last year. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, we did 4 weeks on Take Back Your Time. Our parish nurse really sort of took this on, and it became the most popular event of the Sunday school year. We included the Sunday school kids in on it as well.
How did you do that with the Sunday school? That's great.
Well, the older kids we just brought down with the adults. The younger kids, Mary went up and did some activities around trying life balance and included some conversation with the parents, listening to their children about what they really like to do with their parents and, you know, that sort of thing.
Wonderful. And you did 4 weeks of it.
Right.
Great. One thing I would love to do is if somebody from the church, maybe Mary, would be willing to write up a little something about this and how it worked. We would certainly like to also put that on our website and send it to the Massachusetts Council of Churches, which is now, and that your church is in Decorah, Iowa,
right?
Because they are now proposing this also to the National Council of Churches for, as a priority event. Probably won't happen this year, but maybe for next year. I've just been invited to come to Louisville, Kentucky at the end of August by the Presbyterian Church USA and by their staff. They have about 800 people on staff at their national offices in Louisville, and they're trying to deal with budget cuts. And one of the things that they've thought about, you know, it's been suggested, of course, and that the CEO there has talked about is simply laying off a lot of people. Some of the staff who've gotten interested in this have said, why don't you come and let's meet and talk about how we might instead reduce hours for people and prorate benefits and do things so that we can keep people working, but we don't have people so overworked, because right now a lot of people are overworked. And they've also talked about how they would like to have that then be a model that the church would promote beyond just their national staff, but to pastors and to members of the church throughout the country. So I'm pretty excited about some of these things that are going on. In Massachusetts, and one final thing here, and then we'll close. One of the funny stories that was told to me, in fact, was sent to me by Diane Kessler, who's the executive director. Reverend Kessler is the executive director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. And she said that it's a little kind of tough suggesting what the churches should do for a particular Sunday and things. And if you over-suggest, it's probably just going to create a rebellion and that pastors, just the opposite. But so the difference was that the Massachusetts Council of Churches not only represents all the Protestant denominations and the Unitarians, but it also represents the Greek Orthodox Church. And they have a little bit different sort of setup. It's more of a hierarchy. So in the Greek Orthodox Church is organized into what are called metropolises. In the New England, the metropolis of Boston is in charge of all the churches in New England. And the leader of the church for New England is called the Metropolitan. And his name in Boston is Methodius. So anyway, Methodius the Metropolitan sent out a letter instructing his entire clergy throughout New England to preach on the subject of time and time poverty and overwork on October 24th. And we got a copy of his letter. And, you know, of course, we were hoping that this went to, but Diane said, well, he can do this, you know, and he'll say, when the metropolis speaks, when the metropolitan speaks, everyone listens. But if we encouraged our Protestant pastors to do this, we just have a revolt on our hands, and they'd probably do precisely the opposite. So, anyway, I appreciate all the time that people have spent here in these conversations. I hope that you've gotten something from this and some ideas to take back and to think about, and that you will check out our website and also sign up on the website for our email list. We will not overwhelm you at all. You probably will get one or two things in the course of a month, just usually a newsletter that lets people know what we're doing and what different groups are doing around the country, and kind of keeps you on top of the Take Back Your Time movement and what it's up to, but we do not send out continual things because we know how overloaded people are already. So I don't know if there's any further questions before...
I have a question.
Yes.
Don't quite understand this Take Back Your Time and all this. Is it connected in any way to the PBS?
No.
This is completely separate from your work with PBS?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. That Take Back Your Time movement, I explained it one time, actually is an organization that came out of the Voluntary Simplicity movement, out of what's called the Simplicity Forum, which is kind of an unofficial think tank for the Voluntary Simplicity movement. The Simplicity Forum was started by Vicki Robin, who wrote Your Money or Your Life.
And this is all in what area of the country?
All over the country. Entire
country.
We are basically headquartered in Seattle because that's where I live, and where Cecile Andrews, who's another very active person in this movement, lives, and we have our one part-time paid staff person. We are it's interesting, we're a very small organization in terms of staff. We have one half-time staff person, but we have a board of 30-some very prominent people all around the country who give us input, and we have a lot of organizational members and individual members, and we've gotten a lot of media attention. The really great thing, actually, about this issue is that the press loves us. Reporters are among the most overworked people in the world. So they get it right away. And the media really likes us. And not only the so-called liberal media, but we've had excellent local coverage from Fox in a number, both in Chicago and Seattle, in some other places, just local reporters who saw us and said, hey, this is really neat. We've had stories about us in things like Oprah Magazine and Psychology Today and Time, Newsweek, the New York Times, all kinds of publications have written. The May issue of U.S. Catholic Magazine, the front cover story was about our movement and about the movement to slow things down. And so there was actually in the Lutheran at one point early on in the campaign did a nice story about our campaign. We haven't had much there from there since, but it's good. I mean, we're trying to get the word out, and if you're able to help in any way, obviously we would love to have you. So thank you all so much for your attention. This is my last day. I leave tomorrow to go back to Seattle, and it's always just a terrific honor to be here at Holden, regardless of what I'm here for. It's just a great place where I make so many new friends, and I'm so impressed by the quality of folks who come here and the discussions we have. So thank you for your terrific participation and making my week a wonderful week here. And,